Good afternoon, House Transportation Economic Development Committee come to order. Thanks again to my able co-chair for handling things while we were gone on Friday for the redistricting hearing. I understand it was quite a meeting. I'm sorry I missed it. A couple of housekeeping notes to start. House Bill 3345 will be taken, the content of that bill will be taken up in some of our other discussions and other bills, so we won't be hearing that one. House Bill 3113 and House Bill 3438 have some constitutional problems, and we won't be hearing those as well today or later. And House Bill 3458 will be putting on the agenda for April 20th. So hopefully that makes the agenda a little clearer for people. We will start with the hearing on House Bill 3055 as soon as we have Representative Comp in the room. Representative Hunt, do you want to get us started? Are you okay with that? Okay, so we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3055. I think our committee administrator, who normally gives us a summary, is out searching for Representative Comp. So the duty falls to you, Representative Hunt. Here she is.
And there he is. Perfect. So do you want to yield to your committee administrator?
Zach, do you want to give us a summary? Everyone's ready to go.
House Bill 3055 creates the State Agency Innovation Board and also the State Agency Innovation Fund.
You can go first. Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, and members of the committee. It's nice to see you. I haven't testified in front of this committee. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, which includes the cities of Woodburn, Jervis, as well as Northeast Salem. Colleagues, we are in a tough budget environment. That is no secret. Almost every member of the legislature is combing the budget for ways to save dollars, program by program, line by line. The bill in front of you, House Bill 3055, will help these efforts by encouraging state agencies to find savings within their own budgets. If a state agency finds efficiencies and savings, a portion of their ending fund balance, which would typically be deposited back into the general fund, will instead go to the State Agency Innovation Fund. Once there, those dollars will be available to that same state agency for further projects focused on efficiency and savings. This bill changes things in two critical ways. First, no one understands state agencies better than those who manage it every day. House Bill 3055 empowers agency employees to find ways of doing things better, faster, cheaper. Second, currently state agencies have the incentive to spend every last dollar in their budgets. The goal of this bill is to encourage state agencies to come up with innovation and efficiency ideas within their agencies. We are working on an amendment that will improve the bill, and I urge your support, and I will be here through Representative Hunt's testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to be part of that.
Thank you, Representative Comp. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. This, for those of us who read the recent recommendations that came from SEIU, I think it was a good reminder that those who are doing the work in the agencies a lot of times are those who really are in the best place, often better than we are, even better in some cases than an outside auditor is at identifying potential savings and recommendations. I think the question is, how can we incentivize, almost how can we deputize all state workers to take on that kind of same focus? That those things shouldn't be limited to just an auditor. They shouldn't be limited to just our new Chief Operating Officer, Mike Jordan, or to DAS. We should really have people in every agency with that same incentive. The focus of this bill is really, as Representative Comp said, trying to tilt that balance to give that incentive to a greater degree to those folks in those agencies. I did have an opportunity to sit down with Mike Jordan, who is doing a fabulous job, even though he's only been on the job about 2 weeks. As the Chief Operating Officer and Director of DAS, does he have both those titles, I think? He made a couple of suggestions, and as Representative Kopp and I have thought through how we might simplify this bill even more, keep all the goals in place that Representative Kopp just outlined, but we're in the process of drafting an amendment, and I'll outline a couple of provisions that are likely to be in that amendment. You'll see in line, on page one, on line, both line 11 and line 21, it references the 3% threshold, that this only applies once you get up to 3%. Several folks have suggested that this should just start with dollar one. There should be an incentive from dollar one of savings to save as much as you can. If you can save 2.5% of your agency resources, you should do that. If you can save 6%, you should do that. But there should be an incentive from dollar one. So I think the amendment will eliminate that 3% threshold and have this this incentive, which is basically said, of those dollars that are saved, 10% will be available to that agency, as Representative Kopp said, for streamlining and other improvements. The other 90% would go, and I think another thing the amendment will do will make it more explicit that the dollars will flow into the rainy day fund, not just into the general fund, but those other 90% of savings will flow explicitly into the rainy day fund. The other change that will be in the amendment will be eliminating the formal board. You see in line 27, it talks about identifying a state agency innovation board. Mike Jordan, who would be the one who would be staffing that board, actually suggested saying, this can be a function that the Legislative Emergency Board could actually serve. It wouldn't need to be a full new separate board and the bureaucracy that might entail, but this could be, for determining where those 10% of dollars are allocated, this could be a decision that's made, because it's really just dealing with the limitation authority. That could be something that the Legislative Emergency Board could deal with. And the final change will be adding a provision that during times of economic hardship that the legislature would have the option of temporarily suspending the grant program and using those savings for other purposes. So in all normal years, all normal biennia, the 10% that was saved would be able to be redeployed into those agencies during their next biennium's budget. The only exception would be during times of economic hardship. And we might use the Education Stability Fund triggers, or there may be some other triggers. But I would completely agree with Representative Kopp. I think there's an opportunity to incentivize the same kind of recommendations that we've seen coming recently from some of our state workers through the SEIU proposals, to try and expand out that incentive and save us some money, tighten operations of agencies, and strengthen the public trust in state government.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really pleased to hear about one of the amendments that you described, which is start with dollar one, not 3%, and here's why. So I want to check with you my understanding of how this would work. You might have an agency with four or five or more divisions, each one of them running a pretty distinct operation, and to start achieving efficiencies, you might start in one area or another. You may achieve 10 or 15% savings in that one area, but it would be a smaller fraction than of the whole. So is that one of the intents of this amendment?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson. Absolutely. The focus would be savings on dollar one. I think it would still have to be structured in a way so you'd be dealing with dollar savings. I don't know. A given agency, it might be just one legislatively adopted budget, or that might be in a given agency several, depending on the agency. We'd probably still have to stick within the parameters of the particular legislatively adopted budget, but as long as there's dollar one in savings, that would begin to be split 90% into the rainy day fund, 10% reinvested back into that agency to do additional streamlining and other improvements.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, so I'm sorry I got in here late, but what you're referring to is the SEI proposals. I'm assuming you're talking about the span of control discussion that they've been having, about 5.7 to 11. If not, let me just tee this up on how I think of it in my mind, and that is, so for example, SEIU has talked about expanding the span of control from 5.7 to 11, which would be a savings to the state, at least, or a cost deferral somewhere else, that money could potentially go into a 10% innovation fund, which then they could use at their discretion for finding new additional savings or just implementing the ideas that they've discovered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, I think the part of the answer is yes. We're not specifically, I just gave that as an example of what can happen when state workers actually look at where there can be greater efficiencies, greater savings. And especially, I think, both with their proposal and with this proposal, the whole focus is both how can we do more with less, and there's two sides to that, spending less but also doing more. So one of the areas it may be deployed into is more directly into frontline services. Instead of, I mean, to use your example, if we eliminate dollars from middle management under this proposal, 10% of those could be redeployed into more efficiently delivering services. The other 90% would go into the rainy day fund. That would not be the only kind of cut that could be identified. There are a variety of other savings that might be identified. I don't know if you want to speak to that further.
No, you covered it. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First, let me just say, love the objective of the bill. In terms of the early draft of the bill, pretty much love that, too. So want to get to the bottom more of kind of what the amendments are going to do. And I apologize if this means you're going to be repeating yourself at all. So it seems like there's three elements of the original bill. One is you can save some money. If you save that money, there's a group of people that can then say, okay, you can spend that money in the following ways, and that's sort of the third thing. In the amended bill, we changed maybe each of those three pieces. The who I get, we're take that away from some new board and put it to the e-board or whatever. The others, so how much money are we talking about? What percentage? You said from dollar one, is it up to 10% of the budget? And then what can it be spent on, and how do we be sure if it's not what the board says, you know, that it's going to be spent on innovation or whatever? How do we make sure that the e-board knows that that's what it's to be spent for? And if you end up walking through it again, I apologize, but I want to make sure I really understand it. I really like it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, to some degree, I think we're open to your feedback about exactly, that's why we didn't bring in an amendment.
Great.
I think we're open to your feedback about how exactly that amendment gets drafted from all of you. I think the basic intent is that 10%, the e-board would still play the similar function that's identified here for the State Agency Innovation Board. That probably Mr. Jordan's office within DAS, and I mean technically the governor, I suppose it is, that would be making recommendations for how that 10% could be expended. The major function of the legislature would be required to grant the limitation authority, because DAS nor the governor obviously can say go forth and spend this additional dollars beyond what's legislatively appropriated to them. So the dollars would actually be there, that 10%. The limitation authority would have to be given by the e-board. And I think the intent is to have some criteria that you can't go out and spend it buying a new building. You can't go out and spend it doing certain other things. But where you've got opportunities for greater service delivery, additional streamlining, I think we're really open exactly how those criteria get defined.
Great. Follow up, Mr. Briefly, please.
Yeah. So I don't know what your timeline is, but Representative Kopp and Representative Hunt, if you're actually, questions I would have offline and possibly input, but would be those two things, would be to what, how much money are we talking about, under what circumstances, and then also what are those criteria, who decides. But I think, but again, I don't say that to darn it with faint praise, but quite the opposite. I think this could be really, really valuable, and thank you for bringing it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, when we work as an e-board, we do follow some pretty concise rules and understanding, and if we can reach agreement with an amendment, that's all the more clarity that we can have. And I think that's the value of working at a policy level before it does come down to the ways and means process. So we welcome those ideas, and if there's certain criteria that you think should be, the sideboards on it, then that's what we want to hear.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if this follows on Representative Smith's question about how much money we're talking about. Is there a number already of how much is returned each year that's that's already on the table, so to speak.
Mr. Chair, there is a number. I don't know what that. Obviously, it varies from biennium to biennium. We'd be happy to get that number for you. Currently, that just flows right back into the central pot. Excuse me, which means there's no incentive. I mean, if I'm an employee in DEQ, I have no particular incentive to save a dollar that may be going back into the general pot. Whereas if I know that a portion of that, a tithe of that, 10%, would go back into incentivizing positive behavior, increasing and improving service delivery, then all of a sudden I've got more skin in the game. And so I think our hope is that whatever that number is now, that it could be dramatically enhanced going forward by these kind of incentives.
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, my thought is, particularly in the last two sessions, this time we don't have any money left to sweep, but if we have this in place, then those agencies would know that that money is held in those places. This is not money that would be swept under different conditions. This is about their own innovation funds, and they'd have, to me, they'd have those kind of protections.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're just at the cusp of getting ticked off at me by asking these questions, but just a general statement.
It's not you. I'm just looking at the agenda.
Just to make a general statement, this is how it works in the private sector. You know, I've done it at my firm and other places. They have great incentive for employees. I think it's a great idea. I think I've earned a couple checks here or there by creating, thinking of some innovative ways to save the business money. And if we can implement it in the state in a good way, I think it's a good idea.
Thank you. When do you expect you might have your amendments?
Mr. Chair, when would you like the amendments?
Yesterday.
Well, it would be nice if we had at least 2 days to get feedback from committee members,
okay,
and then follow up with LC after that.
If I'm reading the mood of the committee well, it seems like you would have good support for that.
Okay.
I urge you to do that as quickly as possible. Our workload should have gotten smaller after Friday, and I guess it did to a certain extent, but we got a lot to do, so we'll look forward to seeing you back with your amendments.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. There's no one else who has signed up to testify on House Bill 3055. Is there anyone in the room who would like to be heard on this bill? I don't see anyone.
And
so
let me know when you're going to get to headlines.
We'll get there. Thank you,
Representative Cobb.
So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3055. Look forward to a chance to see that bill again, and open the public hearing on House Bill 2370. Representative Nathanson, this one's yours. If you want to make your way around. And Zach, you could give us a summary, please.
House Bill 2370 requires a political subdivision to give the Department of Transportation at least 30 days notice of intent to sell or transfer property next to a rail infrastructure.
Representative Nathanson, you know as well as we do the length of our agenda, so your brevity will be most appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. This bill is about rail and railroads, and sometimes we need to extend a siding, build a parallel track, build a separated grade crossing. And as you know, sometimes it's pretty darn hard to get right-of-way. Right-of-way can require negotiating with different parties, a number of different individual private property owners. And I'm talking about the railroad buying right-of-way as well as maybe the state. Currently, state and publicly owned land can be sold without consideration for its potential use for a new rail expansion, whether it's parallel track, separated grade crossing or whatnot. That could hamper our ability to improve rail infrastructure. Wouldn't it be a shame to lose property that was already in public ownership for a potential rail use just because no one even knew that it was up for sale? So this bill is really only about communication. It doesn't force anyone to buy anything. It doesn't force anyone to sell anything, but it makes sure that the communications happen so that you know when public property is about to be disposed of that is within a certain parameter, certain proximity to rail. So the objective is to ensure that ODOT is notified for consideration of future rail whenever publicly owned land, and I want to emphasize that not all privately owned, only publicly owned land, it seems to be that it's possibility of being sold. This bill requires public agencies to notify ODOT 90 days prior to the sale or lease of state or other publicly owned land within 100 feet of an existing line or 500 feet of an at-grade rail crossing. This bill does not require anything of private property owners. I've already discussed bill language, and we have an amendment. I've discussed this amendment with a representative of a railroad who brought up a really excellent point. The way some attorneys read the language was different than the way legislative counsel interpreted the language, but nonetheless, we have an amendment to clarify that and satisfy the interest of the railroad. Similarly, the cities of Salem and Portland have communicated with me that there's a small tweak that they would like to have, and I'm working with them proactively on developing the kind of amendment language to make sure that those cities are satisfied that it works all right.
So there's an additional amendment forthcoming?
There will be another amendment, yes.
Okay.
So I hope you'll agree that this is a useful tool that I hope will benefit railroads as well as the public interest. I also want to emphasize that this is about communication. There is a time limit for when a public agency would notify ODOT. Similarly, there's a strict time limit on when ODOT needs to get back to that public entity, because the point is we're not trying to hold up a city or a county and put their property in limbo infinitely. We're trying to make sure that everyone knows what the status of that is, but the owner of the property, the city, the county, whoever, is actually in the driver's seat on this one. If ODOT says it looks like this particular parcel might be useful, then they better do something about it, and that other public agency can determine whether they are willing to wait or not, or offer some other kind of opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Representative Widener.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson, I mean, as I go through this and I can see you're doing a lot of work on this and everything, I'd be very interested, after you get with all the parties, I'd probably check with the land use people as well, just to see, get their input as well, but I can tell you're working hard on it, and I'm hoping it comes back with something that I can agree with as well. So thank you very much for your work.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, it's within 30 days of the offer to sell, not within 30 days of the sale, correct?
Right.
And a follow-up. I'm just wondering if there's other agencies besides ODOT that would want that advance notice as well, and if that's been considered, other agencies that might want to get in line with them as well, counties, cities, etc.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, there may be. The purpose of this bill is really limited because it's within a certain number of feet of a rail right-of-way or a crossing. There may be other agencies who would like to know what each other is doing, and some of those agreements do actually already exist, and this is an amendment to a statute that is more generally applicable to all kinds of sales of public property. We're just putting a special emphasis in this one. If it happens to be proximate to a rail use, that they need to notify ODOT. But there are some larger, more general provisions about the sale of public property generally.
Thank you. We have a number of people who have signed up to testify. So, Representative Benz, I'm sorry, I missed your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The part of the bill that it gives me the greatest concern, and folks that are signed up may mention it, but it's on the second page on line 6, where the political subdivision, quote, shall give the department the first opportunity to obtain the real property. That sentence is really quite difficult from many different angles, which I won't bother you with, but has that sentence received discussion in your workup of the bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, most of the discussion has been up to date. There hasn't been a lot on that particular aspect, except that the railroads would actually benefit if they were to receive notice from ODOT, and in fact, the amendment addresses that, and I hope you hear about that later, because the purpose is to preserve rail use, and if the railroads...
That's the new amendment, or the one that the dash 2 that we
the
have?
The dash 2, it says, the department shall share the advance notice with private providers of rail service service that might be interested in obtaining it, because the primary objective is to preserve rail use. And so if this would be useful for extending a siding, building a parallel track or whatever, the rail companies would very much benefit from and like to know about this piece of property that would be available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Roger Martin, Jerry Boward, Ron Papsdorf, and then two more after that. So on deck, Craig Honeyman and Heidi Stutzman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent, along with Cindy Robert, the Union Pacific Railroad, and we are not here in opposition. We might even be in support. We are confused or still trying to figure out exactly what the intent is and if there's an issue being addressed. Let me give you a brief background. The Union Pacific Railroad is probably one of the top 12 property tax owners and payers of property tax. And we own more property. We pay some of the top dozen in the way of property tax, and we've been doing that for 130 years. We are also very safety concerned, and often we get into a conflict of sorts with public entities who would like a piece of property or use of our right-of-way for walking paths, bike paths, and those kind of things, which are ever more popular. Our concern is safety. Railroads are very dangerous. There was an accident on another line in Washington recently, and I don't have to illustrate to you that hazards happen, and often it's the railroad that gets blamed, whether it's their fault or not. So we try very hard to avoid conflicts. If we knew that the property would be available to us, but the concern is, and I can't give you a specific instance, a public entity buying a piece of land immediately adjacent or in sometimes between several rail lines and making it open for public use, it just increases the danger, the safety concern. So we're anxious to watch this to make sure that we don't get in an unintended consequences kind of situation, and I will be interested to hear what the cities are asking for. We cooperate with cities and counties and the state of Oregon all over this state, but occasionally we have a problem when some city department wants to use it for a purpose that we think is rather not safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's hear from the panel, and then we'll take questions. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm the Interim Deputy Director of Operations for ODOT. And I'll just speak very briefly. I think that Representative Nathanson did a great job of explaining the bill. And just to say that ODOT supports the bill. We have seen the Dash 2 amendments, which we support as well. And really what we do see this is as another tool in the toolbox. And as the representative referred to, a communication opportunity. As you all know, railroads are vital to our transportation system, whether we're talking about passenger or whether we're talking about freight. And any opportunity to have another tool in the toolbox to make sure that there's an opportunity to increase the capacity is an advantage. I think you all may have perhaps heard about the 2010 rail study, which really outlined the current condition and the use of the rail network and really recognized that the future growth of rail was important. So not sure what to add other than I think a couple of questions that were raised around, I think, line six, the first opportunity to attain real property. I think this really comes back to being the first right of refusal. And also it's important to note really in this bill as well that we are required to go through rulemaking. And really what I see that is really clarifying the process that we'll use to get work on notification, whether it's a notification from the local government or notification to the railroads. So with that, I'll close and just say that we're in support of this bill and look forward to the next steps.
Thanks very much. Mr. Papsdorf.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Ron Papsdorf representing the city of Gresham. not here opposed to the goal of the stated goal of the bill. I think communication, when there's a potential transfer of publicly owned right-of-way near a railroad, can be a good thing. We do have some questions, though, that we feel could bear some clarification in the bill, principally whether this language applies to light rail rights-of-way. We have a light rail line through Gresham. We've got significant publicly owned properties next to the light rail line, where our objective is to actually create new transit-oriented high-density development. We don't think there's an expansion. We think there's an unnecessary kind of step of notification in that sort of case, so maybe exempting those sorts of facilities would be appropriate. We also have the Springwater Trail, which is a rails-to-trails corridor through Gresham, extends all the way into Portland and east of Gresham. Unclear to us whether a rails-to-trails corridor, which technically remains a rail right-of-way, would be affected by this. And finally, we share, I think, a question that's come up already in the hearing, is what the language give the department the first opportunity to obtain the real property, what that actually means, and how that would be executed, for how long, through what kind of process, how does that relate to situations where we may be working with a private partner to redevelop a piece of property. Not sure how we can even get the interest from a private developer to talk to us and start to develop a redevelopment plan if this is kind of potentially hanging out there as a possible a measure where the department could decide that they want to acquire the property. So we'd like to see some clarification in the bill at the very least.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to build on the remarks that were just made, normally when we put together a right of first refusal, we always charge the party benefiting from the right something for it, because it's a chill on the ability of the owner of the property to sell it. And so that there's a cost to that, and many times it's the cost of blowing up a deal that you're trying to put together while you make the offer to the department. So to me, the question that this bill raises, which you've just mentioned, is whether or not the value that we're taking away from the cities in some fashion is justified by needing to have the department have this right. That's the question, because we're not asking that the department pay anything for this chill being placed upon the ownership of the property. So that's why I brought that up, and I think we're hearing about it.
And Representative Benz, is it true, I mean, you would know this, of course, I don't, when those things happen, is there typically and maybe I'm just not reading it well, is there typically an expiration on that right of first refusal? In other words, at some point, the department theoretically should have to actually refuse and maybe not continue to say, well, we're still thinking about it. Does that typically happen?
Right. And Mr. Chair, and I think that's what Jerry was referring to when they do the rulemaking. All of the elements of the right of first refusal would come into to high relief. But at the end of the day, the issue is how much has the department paid the owner, because the owner, are going to bear the chill that goes with the existence of the device.
Understood. My question was not real. I mean, it was just building on yours, but that's helpful.
Right.
Thank you. Other questions? Let's see. Thank you very much. Last two on our list: Craig Honeyman, Heidi Stutzman.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Stutzman. I'm here today to represent the City of Salem. And I want to duplicate what the Gresham representative said. We have no problem with the intent of the notification part of the bill. Where we get a little hung up is on the right of first refusal, as it's been called, on page 2, line 6. The sponsor of the bill has graciously offered to work with us to try to allay our concerns, and so I just really wanted to put on the record that the council has taken a position opposed to this bill, but we're working to try to get those things straightened out.
Thank you. I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Mr. Honeyman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, Craig Honeyman, League of Oregon Cities. I, too, in speaking for the League, I'm here to say that we agree with the intent of this bill, the fostering of communication to avoid missed opportunities, in this particular case, between cities who might own land adjacent to rail facilities and ODOT. We were pleased to have been included during the interim in discussions about this legislation by its sponsor, Representative Nathanson. Expressed concerns about needing some sidebars, most of which have been added to the bill, including a stricter definition of exactly what kind of properties we're talking about, and sort of spatial relationships to rail facilities. Those have been addressed. Time limitations have been addressed, 30-day notification by a city to ODOT, 30 days to respond. There remains, in our mind, a question of beyond that sort of 60-day window, if ODOT was to declare an interest, how long they have to do the deal with the city. I am encouraged by the remarks that I just heard from Representative Nathanson relative to that this is not an intent to hold up city's disposition of property that they wish to sell. In fact, I think I heard Representative Nathanson say we were in the driver's seat, but the truth or the proof will be in the details. It'll come through the regulatory or the rulemaking process, which we would intend to be engaged in. So with those sort of caveats, if you will, the league does not oppose this bill. We will be interested in working with the cities of Portland and Salem to address their concerns. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. So, Representative Nathanson, we'll wait to see your next amendment and obviously encourage your continued conversation with everyone. Did you want to say something?
Yes, Mr. Chair, sure. I want to assure you that, yes, I have promised, and we have been discussing the nature of what the amendments should be. I've been working with Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities and those specific entities, and I think Mr. Martin and I are even on the same page about how this ought to work. So
glad to hear it.
We'll
Thank
try to make it happen.
Sounds good. Thank you. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2370. Mr. Martin, thanks for your patience. We got to the bill. And we'll hear, let's open the public hearing next on House Bill 2329. Zach.
House Bill 2329 just alters the definitions of all-terrain vehicles, adding a Class 4 category.
Thank you. So let's have Kylene Stone, please. Rod Roberts. And here's a difficult name to read. Daryl, maybe? Pretty sure it starts with a D. Okay. Daryl Vaughn. Vaughn, please.
Go forward.
So if you'd like to have a seat at the front here. And Rod Roberts and Ms. Vaughn, two more seats here if you want.
You've got to testify for, you've got to testify against.
That's fine. You can all sit at the same table. We're all here together.
I'm re-emphasizing what he says.
Okay. And what's your name, sir?
My name is Gary Scott.
Okay.
We're
going to let the department go first, but I'm just keeping track of who has signed up and who is here. So
okay,
go ahead first, please.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kylene Stone. I'm an assistant director at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. First of all, thank you very much for getting this bill scheduled. We appreciate it. This bill really represents kind of the current state of thinking in the ATV community, and is the result of the recommendations of the ATV Advisory Committee. And that committee was convened as a result of the 2009 Senate Bill 578. And that committee includes representatives who ride ATVs, also dealers, ATV dealers. It includes land managers, including the Forest Service, the BLM, and the State Forestry Department. Includes local law enforcement, and then other state agencies such as the Department of Transportation. So I'm pleased to present this bill to you today. I also wanted to thank Representative Beyer for her assistance in helping us get the amendments through the process. If you can indulge me for one moment, I just want to give you a quick history of the ATV program and why someone from State Parks is here giving this presentation today. The ATV grant program was actually transferred to State Parks in 2000 from the Department of Transportation. There are actually no ATV riding areas on state park lands, so we administer this program on behalf of the broader ATV community. And back in 2006, there were several really tragic accidents accidents where children in particular were dying in ATV accidents, and there was sort of a call to action that was actually raised through a series of articles in the Oregonian that someone needed to take control of the ATV safety question. There really was nobody responsible for that. So that was tasked to the department, the Parks and Recreation Department. And as a result, in 2007, Senate Bill 101 was passed, which instituted the ATV Safety Program. And since that program was instituted, we have developed an online safety training curriculum, and it is required for all children and their families who ride in public riding areas. And then we're also developing a hands-on training program in cooperation with 4-H that will be required, again, for people who ride on public lands for recreation. And then also we've established guidelines to ensure that younger riders do fit on their ATVs. There's been a lot of concern in the ATV community from riders that that families would basically be squeezed out of the sport if we were to put a minimum riding age. So we've come up with some alternatives and done quite a bit of negotiation both between riders and safety advocates in order to create the program that we have in front of us today. So now, in 2009, ATV enthusiasts again came to the legislature, then Senator Rick Metzger, and he co-sponsored some legislation that created the task force, or the ATV Advisory Committee in Senate Bill 578. They then met through a series of public meetings, heard testimony from a variety of interested parties, and have provided the recommendations that you see here in 2329 through the -4 amendments. What the bill does specifically is creates a new classification of ATVs. We're calling it Class 4. Currently, there are three classifications of ATVs. There are quads, there are which is Class 1. There are Class 2s, which essentially are Jeeps and dune buggies. And then there are Class 3s that are dirt bikes. This would add a new class, Class 4, which would represent what they call side-by-sides or utility vehicles. And they differ from quads in a couple of significant ways. One, in the fact that a quad is steered with a handlebars, and a side-by-side is steered by a steering wheel. And then also that a quad is meant to be ridden on a tractor seat or a seat that you straddle, whereas a side-by-side is ridden on either bucket seats or bench seats. These distinctions are important because there are different safety requirements, different operator requirements, training requirements that are needed for the two different types of vehicles. And this just clears up some of the confusion that currently exists because those quads are not, or because those side-by-sides are not currently represented in the statutes. This also establishes certification and training requirements for that new Class 4 category, and also adds a position on the ATV committee, advisory committee, to represent that class of users, so that all classes of users would be represented. The bill also makes a couple of technical adjustments. One adds a representative for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and one corrects some errors, actually, that you heard about on April 1st in the hearing on House Bill 3024, corrects the ands and ors so that we can that law enforcement can actually prosecute when people violate safety codes, particularly in relation to their children. This bill does not impose any new fees. This bill does not apply anywhere but on public recreation lands. It does not apply on private land or in the act of farming or forestry work. And this bill does not mandate, prescribe, or prohibit the use of any vehicle in any location. What it does do is gives land managers a clearer indication of the different types of vehicles that they can expect on their land so that they can design the riding areas according to those expectations. All decisions about the types of vehicles that may be ridden rest really at the sole discretion of the land managers, and they base their decisions on a lot of factors, including terrain, the suitability of the land, the capacity of their bridges, other engineering factors, natural resource considerations, etc. So that's really a summary of what the bill does, and I can answer any questions.
Thanks. Let's hear from the panel first, and then we'll take some questions. I suppose I should have said Deputy Roberts or Sheriff Roberts?
Deputy Roberts is fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Rod Roberts. I'm a corporal with the Coos County Sheriff's Office. I work on the Oregon Dunes and have for the last 10 years been involved in working on the Oregon Dunes in the ATV program. Last year, I was appointed to the State ATV Advisory Committee as a law enforcement representative. I am the co-chair of the Grants Committee, And working with the larger committee and the subcommittee, we discussed these laws and these issues, listened to public input for and against, and it was our opinion after listening to all concerned groups, including the land managers, that we come up with a new class of ATV. And as the ATV committee, we support this, and that's why it was sent forward. As a law enforcement officer, I also believe that it would be a good idea because currently the ATV is in a Class 2 ATV. It's not a Class 1. It might be in some of the class new Class 4 ATVs, the side-by-sides, might be under 48 inches or 50 inches in width, but they're over in the weight. And if we don't put them in their own class, we're going to have issues of children trying to operate them, coming up with a brand-new training program for those. If we leave them as a class or make them as a Class 4, it will help land managers, it will help law enforcement, and the users to understand the laws with those.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Scott. And thank you for printing your name next to your signature. It makes it easier to read.
Thank you very much for listening
and
to
me. And you can just move the microphone a bit away. It will not distort. We'll be able to hear this
right.
Thank you.
Is that about right?
That's perfect.
Okay. I don't know. I do a little picking and grinning, so I learned to eat the microphone.
That's good.
My name is Gary Scott. My safety qualifications are, I'm a former member of the Oregon State Highway Traffic Safety Advisory Committee, Citizens Advisory, a former Motorcycle Safety Foundation instructor, and an active bicycle safety advocate. My technical qualifications are, I've been a power sport designer for over 40 years. I've worked for many major manufacturers. I have over 60 patents, 10 design awards. I'm a former racer and factory test rider. I'm currently working on the design of a much safer, more environmentally friendly Class 1 vehicle, suitable for both able-bodied and disabled persons, that House Bill 2329 would kill dead. House Bill 2329 is like Henry Ford saying, the Model T is good enough, we're going to drive the stake right here. House Bill 2329, Section 1, is an anti-safety bill of all things. I never thought I'd see it in my entire life. It outlaws vehicles that have seat belts, roll cages, safety nets, side doors that fit within the 50-inch trails fine. I got a vehicle that fits within the 50-inch rule when it came out in 2008. For my handicapped wife. We've ridden for 4 years and 5,000 miles without any problems on Class 1 trails with all the quad riders. The only problem was weight, and they've got to raise the weight anyway. They've got to raise the weight because the quads have gotten heavier. And also, the weight they're proposing is not even high enough. The Polaris 6x6 quad, which I was out repairing trails with this weekend, with my razor pulling a trailer, it weighs 115 pounds more than my razor. Now, I've got a 50-inch razor. If you refer to page four, you'll see a 50-inch razor with a 50-inch quad. There is not going to be any confusing, one being larger than the other. They fit on the same trails. They go on the same trails. I can get all sorts of people. By the way, there's been testimony here of land managers that are for it. The people that have pushed the bills are, you know, pro-quad. They think quads belong in a separate category. That's fine if it didn't cause harm to other people, because there's no harm in allowing a 50-inch wide vehicle of a different configuration. I'm not going to read through this whole thing. I suggest you do read it. These vehicles are almost identical. If you look on them, page 4, they're almost identical mechanically. They use the same motors. They just have different configured seating. The difference is the guy on the right is sitting up exposed. If that rolls over, he's going to get smashed. People in the other one have safety equipment. Now, the safety equipment is no better than the user. If it's not used, there is as much risk as the person in the open. The particular advantage as I got into this. I really just got into this because Daryl Vaughn, who's a paraplegic, you're going to hear from shortly, who's going to be severely hurt if this bill does not isn't altered and amended as we recommend.
And just in the interest of time, maybe you could get to the your recommendations on how you'd like to see it amended or changed.
On the last page is the recommendation. It's very very simple on page 7. And it really goes back to the origins. If the 50-inch width unchanged, and if you refer to page, let's see, what is it, 6? Page 6, you can see a 60-inch wide side, 60-inch wide side by side compared to the 50-inch wide. First place, they won't fit in trails. They won't fit through the gates. They won't fit through the rocks. And it's very obvious the difference. If it requires a special sticker or something to get these things qualified, all of us would be glad to do that. But quite frankly, for two people, having this kind of vehicle with all these safety protections is going to save lives, absolutely going to save lives. I gave you my technical qualifications. I have no problem with solo quads. I have a lot of concern with two-up quads. You get two people trapped between a backrest and handlebars. The thing starts to go over, even if they're able-bodied. They got to get clear. They're all tangled around each other. Representative Widener, I know you know about these things. You know these vehicles and you like them. And we're not anti-quad. Daryl owns four of them. But when it comes to safety for two people, if you look at page 5, there's Daryl in his quad. He's hurt himself in his side-by-side vehicle, 50 inches. He's hurt himself on quads. If you refer to page 3, in the bottom there, you'll see me with my grandson, all strapped in, by the way, with the booster seat. And by the way, thankfully to this committee, last time I testified for this committee, you passed the booster seat requirement, which makes it safe for children to ride. Above is a picture of two ups. If they're ridden with care, fine. But all the time I see people riding around with kids flopping around on the back. If you're elderly, my wife has she's got limited mobility. It's just not safe for her to ride on that. Okay, the way that House Bill 2329 is written.
Mr. Scott, if you could start wrapping up for just a second, I'd really appreciate it. We've got a lot of people here. So is that a reasonable place to wrap up?
If House Bill 2329 is passed as it is written, people are going to get hurt. People are going to get killed.
Thank you.
I think that's enough.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Wyden.
Real quick, and there's a lot of these things that I do have concern with, but for the...
Mr. Scott, he may be asking you a question. He may be asking you a question.
Yes. Could come back. I'm going to start with parks first. But,
have a seat, please.
You said children had died and everything. I'm just wondering how many children have been killed on quads and everything, because this very same committee last session passed a bill to strap kids to a quad. The last thing you want to do is be strapped to a quad when it's rolling. So I'm just kind of curious what prompted all of this going on, because you're bringing a lot of information to people who haven't ridden quads, they're not familiar with them, and they're just assuming, since you're the agency, you're making the right decision. And that bill was brought to us by an agency before. So I'd like to know how many children have been killed, what were the situations that were killed, and how would this prevent those deaths from happening?
Co-chairs Reed and Bence, Representative Widener. Actually, since the implementation of Senate Bill 101, which was the mandatory safety training bill, there have been no deaths of children in public riding areas. Also, the bill that came before the last legislative session to buckle folks in was actually sponsored by advocates and was not something that the agency brought forward. So there have been no deaths since the passage of Senate Bill 101, which was two biennia back. We don't know, and even before that, the number of deaths were running, 4-6 a year, so we don't actually know cause and effect yet, although we're studying it. We don't have data yet because the program hasn't been up and running long enough, but the preliminary indicators are that our safety education is certainly helping. In regard to the side-by-sides and the safety need and the impact on children, there are some side-by-sides that that are the manufacturer recommends a riding age down to the age of 12. And so one of the issues that we're facing is you've got children in some cases who can ride some of these pieces of equipment. And so we do need to develop some safety curriculum for those and some requirements in order to certify them eligible to ride and some supervisory requirements for their parents when they're driving them. So that's really what this House Bill 2329-4 does.
And if I may follow up,
please.
Have you looked at the proposed amendments on the testimony that was brought to us here on the back page? Had a chance to glance at those? Because these make total sense to me.
Chairs Benson, Reed, Representative Widener, I have not had a chance to look at those, and I don't know how well they conform to what's already been, what's in Dash 4 or not. But we can certainly look at those. We have a dry weight now in Class 1 of 1,200 pounds in the Dash 4s and in the Class 4s of 1,800 pounds. So I don't know if those are within the realm of what has been recommended.
Okay, thank you.
Are there further questions?
If I could respond, by the way, we are thankful for the many positive contributions that the Parks and Recreation has made to the sport. And this is just one other area of objection, and do want to say that we do have a lot of support from land managers, from clubs, and so it is kind of a split issue. There is no harm in allowing side-by-sides of the proper size and weight. There's no harm that we can get anybody to respond to us to in doing that. There is possible harm in not allowing them. And so I think that should make the decision clear. The weight's already been taken care of. So we're down to steering by handlebars or straddle seating, and those are relevant issues. Daryl is paraplegic. He can no longer ride a straddle seat vehicle. He needs strapped in. I want my grandsons strapped in a seat, in a booster seat, and all safe. That's, to me, a very small thing to ask. And so please consider it. Take it under careful consideration. Read this when you've got time. I've got my email on there. I will respond to any questions. And the last thing I want to say, if Dale and I are mistaken, if there's something we've overlooked and we're wrong, we'll be the first to admit it and go along with the program. But we haven't had anybody come up with anything yet.
You understand the importance of the width and stuff for their trails and everything, because if they're
absolutely
designing it for 50 inch and you run a 60 and it rolls, then the state's liable. So
absolutely, and I'd rather have that 50 inch vehicle have a roll cage and seat belts in it if I'm in it. And I think about your mom, your kid, if you're out there. Make it personal and think about the choice when you make the decision. Thank you very much.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I guess what we're talking about is this picture on page 6. I'm not sure if this is an accurate picture, but I'm going to take it on face value that it is. Between...
That's an accurate picture. No,
I know that you say it's accurate. I get this from you. What I don't know is if anybody else thinks it's an accurate picture, but I'm not going to contest the matter. Assuming it is accurate. So what we're talking about is that this 60-inch would be a new class and would be okay, and that this 50-inch would not fit within a class and therefore not okay? Is that just so I understand the basics of what we're talking about? Is that right?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, there's the one misunderstanding that seems to be propagated here is that this 2329 does not prohibit anybody from writing anything anywhere. It just clarifies that, yes, both of those would fall in the same classification because of the distinctive characteristic of the fact that you drive them with a steering wheel and that they are then they're either bench or bucket seats. The width and the weight then would either, they'll either be a class 4, or if they're too heavy or too wide, they'll actually fall into the category that a Jeep would fall in, and they'll be required to be driven on roads and not on trails.
That's helpful. Can I have a couple follow-ups just so I understand this?
Yes.
Madam Chair, thanks.
Oh, please.
So what we're talking about then is that this smaller thing on page 6 would not be disallowed. It would be included, it would be considered the same as that bigger thing, okay? And then is there a reason why, and I'm going to come back to you in just a second, is there a reason why that's bad? Is there a reason why that kind of vehicle shouldn't be considered in the same class? And then I want to ask you the same question, but I first want to hear you say it. Any reason why that would be bad to be included in the same class?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, they may be in the same class. If that vehicle on the left there mm-hmm. is wider or heavier, mm-hmm. It could fall into that into
might
a
be a
class
Jeep.
Too. It might be a Jeep, right? And then it wouldn't be on the trails. And so what we've tried to do with the advice of the advisory committee, which does have land managers on it, and I do believe we have a land manager here to testify as well. It may or may not be bad, and there may be considerations that the land managers themselves would make as to whether or not it would be appropriate to ride those either of those vehicles on their lands or any at all. So
roughly same question to you, but with a little bit of change. Is your concern that the vehicle you have, or the vehicle you want to design, ride, sell, whatever, is going to fall between the cracks of the classifications, or is it that if you are required to fit within that category, that it'll burden you in some way because of the way that category is burdened?
The category discriminates unfairly against a vehicle strictly because of seating and steering. Discriminates and wants to segregate.
Now, what I don't understand is is when you say it discriminates, I get the basic arguments, right? But what I don't understand is the facts. When you say it discriminates against that vehicle, how does it do that?
That's okay. Thank you. What it does, if this vehicle, which now fits the weight, already fits the width. The only exception is the way it's steered and the way you sit in it. If it is not considered a class 1, it will not be able to ride on the same trails. My wife and I travel with, we ride with clubs, we ride with friends. We will no longer be able to ride on the same trails with the same vehicle.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
At least now I understand the issue.
Pardon me.
Yes. Go ahead,
Robert.
Chair, committee members, one of the things that we looked at when we did this is the RZR 2, which these gentlemen have, or the RZR, it is, by law right now, a Class 2 ATV. It is under 50 inches in width, but it's 945 pounds. The way the law is now, it has to be under 800 pounds for dry weight. So it falls within the Class 2. So the trails that they have been riding on, where they might have been, I don't know. If they were riding them on Class 1 trails, they've been allowed to by the land managers. If it says no Class 2s, they've actually been riding beyond what the law allows, but that's up to the land managers. By placing it in a Class 4 of its own, it actually opens up a lot of different trails to land managers across the state to look at and say, hey, you know, we can allow Class 4s on this trail. We can allow them here, here, and here, where if they stay in the Class 2s, they're not allowed. So it actually opens up the possibility to adding hundreds of miles of trails across the state of Oregon to the Class 4 ATV, which means they could ride in different places.
Representative Widener.
With doing it this way, using the steering wheel and everything, I can see us kind of being discriminatory towards people that are disabled. What if a person only has one arm? They cannot ride a Class 1. They have to go to a steering wheel type situation. So with us using that to make the classification, I see some problems here. So I think we need to do some work on this and make sure we take care of it to where we don't discriminate against people to where they can't ride on public lands.
Can I respond? Chair Beyer, Representative Widener.
Although we're going to have to move.
I'd like to at least give it a run.
Yeah, you'll be called up. Thank you.
There are also ADA laws that land managers are required to accommodate, and so the local land manager will have to make accommodations for people with disabilities. And again, this does not prohibit land managers from allowing people to ride. All it does is clarify, particularly for the purpose of safety training, that there is a different classification because these vehicles have different requirements for the drivers of the vehicles. Different skill sets are required, different training requirements are required, different minimum ages, and this allows, again, for the clarity in the safety training curriculum for the difference between handlebar and steering wheel and saddle seat and bucket seats, as well as fit requirements that are required. A child fits differently on a quad than they would in a utility vehicle, and that's what this clarifies first and foremost, and does not in any way prohibit a land manager from making disability accommodations for people who ride on their lands.
Thank you. Quickly, and then we'll move to the next
very
couple
quickly.
Of people.
To address the corporal's concern about weight, which was the only category in which the vehicle we're talking about exceeded the original Class 1 specification, is that, matter of fact, the land managers and state people are using the Polaris Trail Boss, which weighs 115 pounds more. They've been using it for years. And in talking to the officials with the people with the boots on the ground, they said, yeah, well, they've gotten bigger and heavier, and so we're going to have to change the weight requirement. The Polaris Razor Trail is no longer the heaviest ATV out there by 115 pounds. The other one is it's fine to say, gee, the land managers can do this and let you ride here and let you ride there, but if it's not a Class 1 vehicle, it segregates us from our friends. It segregates Daryl from the people he can ride with. He'll address that. He won't be able to ride on the trails he's been riding on all his life.
Thank you. With that, we have Daryl, and I'll let you give us your last name, and Nathan Siebel.
Yeah, it's Daryl Vaughn.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have a big agenda, so we need to...
Yeah. We're talking about basically about four side-by-sides that even fall in this class. All the rest of them are fine if they go in Class 4. It's a 50-inch wide machine. It's got a roll bar. I bought this machine because I've rolled over backwards three times. I've rolled several times on my quad. So I spent the money to get a 50-inch machine, and this is the Razor, of which is only a few of them, you know, the model size is 50-inch. Everything else is bigger. That's fine if they go in Class 4, but I went to this machine because I've gotten hurt too many times on my big quad. That's a 50-inch machine. So the biggest thing here is that they're saying Class 1 has to have a straddle seat and a handlebar steering. Well, I've been on the quad, and it's just too dangerous. I've hurt myself too many times, so that's why I went to the 50-inch Razor. I now have a roll bar. I'm now in a bucket seat. I now have protection. I'm lower standard gravity. I have 50 or 20 more inch wheelbase as far as width. And so to tell me now I can't go on my Class 1 trails that I've been riding on for the last 20 years, it just isn't fair. They say it doesn't discriminate, but it is. The Class 1 trail that's 20 miles behind my house, BLM says, no, you cannot take that machine on a Class 1 trail, even though it's exactly almost the same as a 2-up as far as width and length and weight. And so I just, they said, it's too easy to have the Razor just fall into Class 4, you know, and not look at it. It's not right, you know. There's a forum out there, it's the Razor Forum, and 98% of them say it should be fine that the Razor falls into Class 1. So there's a lot of people out there that favor this little Razor, and now you're saying I can't go on the Class 1 anymore. It's just because of the handlebars and the straddle seat. That's basically the issue, you know. For the 50-inch wide machine, and it's safe, it should be able to go on there. The weight's not a criteria because there's several 2-ups that are in that 900 to 1,000-pound weight. So all I'm saying is the straddle seat and the handlebar steering to eliminate my class, the class Razor, the small one, isn't fair, isn't right. So.
Thank you.
I have a quick question for you. I think maybe that confused me a little more, but are you allowed now on that Class 1 property?
No.
So, and if this bill were to pass, you're still not allowed on
it. It's too easy for BLM to say the Class 1 is this, and therefore we're not going to look at it. You're side-by-side, and therefore you will not go on my Class 1 trail, even though this is a small machine, and yes, it's more safer. We don't want to have to try figuring out whether that machine, you know, because it's so unique, we're just going to say, no, it's a Class 4. You can't go. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Nathan.
Yeah, co-chairs of committee, thank you for listening to me. I wasn't prepared to come and speak, so I'm speaking a bit
off the
cuff.
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, my name's Nathan Sable.
Thanks.
I work for the Oregon Department of Forestry, and we manage over 8 riding areas around the state and over 500 miles of trail. And I also am on the OPRD advisory committee that helped come up with these with the Class 4 definition. we stand in support of this bill for a variety of reasons. One is that we feel that it'll give the land managers better tools and clarity on how to deal with this type of machine that'll help us more appropriately in our trail planning decide where it can go for safety reasons and also for the protection of natural resources. Now, currently right now as it stands, our Class 1 trails do not allow Class 2 machines. The Razor and other side-by-sides currently are Class 2s. We believe that changing, creating the Class 4 and changing that definition to include the Razor and the Class 4 and other side-by-sides isn't going to change much the way that we plan and manage trail. We still have to make those decisions of safety. We still have to make decisions on whether or not that machine and its capabilities can run on that trail without hurting the natural resources or water quality if we have crossings or also near bodies of water. The Class 2, it is true that the Razor right now has the width and length that can go on a Class 1 trail, but the turning radius requires more than a quad, and the clearance is not as much as a quad. And so what that can do and what we've found that it does on our Class 1 trails is if there are rocks or roots on a trail where someone in a Razor might not want to bottom out, they're going to tend to go around that, and they're going to widen the trail. We have that situation. We have areas around trails where if they can't make the turning radius of a particularly on the Tillamook State Forest where we have steep terrain, or there's a lot of switchbacks, if they can't make that turning radius, then they try to turn around and go back. And when they do that, they ride trample vegetation, also can cause erosion problems. So the way we look at this is that we support it as it stands. We're still going to have to make decisions on the ground as to where we're going to allow those Class 2s, or I'm sorry, those Class 4s. It could very well be that we look at some of our current Class 1 trails and decide, yes, this trail can accommodate a Class 1 and it can accommodate a Class 4. And we're going to have to change our signing and our maps to reflect that. One of the benefits that we see of creating this Class 4 is that it legitimizes the users who use these types of machines. Right now, the Class 1s and Class 2s and 3s, as they've been established, are pretty well organized as user groups, as members of the public. They have clubs. They have money that they could go to obtain funding to support their machines, their activities on public lands, whereas Class 4s don't. And so we see this as a way of moving in the direction of helping organize those in the OHV community who use Class 4s in such a way that land managers will now have someone to engage with. There'll be clubs, there'll be individuals, there'll be organizations that they can engage in long-term trail planning. So in that regard, it's going to increase, it could increase the benefits and the use of those machines.
Thank you. Representative Wyden.
Yeah. Real quickly, I have troubles buying the argument that they don't have as much clearance as a regular quad because I have a regular quad and my brother has one of these, well, a Kawasaki version of this. and his has more ground clearance than my quad. But I'm just wondering about taking a 50-inch rig, throwing it into the same class as a Jeep, or where pickups would be going, because I've tried running those trails and some of those hills on my quad, and the only time I've gotten hurt up in the hills is trying to go up a hill where they've been and rutted it out, where they'll bog out and they dig a hole. You hit that, the front end comes up, all of a sudden it's flipping over backwards. You're trying to get out of the way, and it lands on you. These here have a roll bar to keep you safe from that, but now you're putting them in a dangerous spot because they're having to maneuver where cars have been, and it's more dangerous for them to try and climb hills. So I'm just wondering if we need to look at another classification, because I support the classification process, because this is where we came into issues with seat belts and everything else and how they're designed. But to throw them up with a Jeep, I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Well, currently, as it stands, all of the Class 2s, including the Razor, all of the side-by-sides, including the Razor, are considered Class 2s. And so all of our Class 2 trails are open to them. And that's part of the problem, that just because the trail is wide enough, it doesn't mean it can handle that machine, even though it's a Class 2 that can handle a Jeep. And so what this is going to help us do is to have better tools that we can clarify even Class 2 trails where a potential Class 4 might be able to fit. We can then now sign it as a Class 2 that can't accommodate a Class 4 or can, because right now they're kind of lumped together and using the same trails, and the trails are not specifically designed for the Razor or the other Class 2s. So it's going to give us tools to better do trail planning, decide where they go and where they can't go. What we expect in the future, that this will add opportunity for them, not take it away. Because there's, as they come to us as land managers and say, hey, we now are legitimate, we want a place to ride, we're going to go and look at where we can accommodate them and start providing areas, whereas right now they're just pretty much stuck to Class 2 trails and roads.
One quick follow-up.
Follow-up, but we got to move on.
What type of vehicle are you using when you're clearing these trails? Are you using a Class 1 or Class 2 vehicle?
We're using quads and motorcycles.
That would fall
right
into
now.
Class 2?
Class 1.
Thank you, and I'm gonna wrap this up. Thank you for the.
May I respond, please? Just give me 60 seconds, please.
We really need to get moving on. So if
these need to be responded. Thank you very much.
I'm gonna go ahead. What?
I'm gonna be very brief. Darrell Road. Darrell Road, the trails he was talking about.
Okay, and I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2329.
People's lives are at stake.
We have a lot of business to do.
May I have
We've
30
had
seconds
plenty of time to
talk. Respond,
so,
please.
Thank you, and the public hearing is closed. And with that, we're going to go to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. House Bill 3072, and we have Representative Comp waiting. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 3072.
I didn't think you were going to get to me just yet. Here's my test.
Welcome back.
Welcome. Thank you, Co-Chair Beyer, and I see Representative Benz is gone too, but that's fine. My name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, which includes the cities of Woodburn, Jervis, as well as Northeast Salem. I come to you today. This is a constituent request about public safety and headlights, and he has worked with me on this bill for over a year, but he is not here today because his mother is very ill in Southern California. And so I asked for your indulgence to just hear a little bit about this bill And House Bill 3072 would require the use of headlights at all times while driving. A lot of the new cars have that installed in them, and it really does make a difference. Headlights are fundamentally important to the operation of our motor vehicles. They allow motorists to see at night as well as times of bad weather. I don't know if any of you happened to be driving I-5 last week during some of our rain showers. I think that was torrential, but if you didn't have your headlights on, it was harder to see each other. Headlights are as much for drivers around you as they are for the driver. This bill addresses an issue about being visible to other drivers, not about seeing better. I submit the record of testimony of a consultant of mine, a constituent of mine, Alan Scott, who has acted as the primary drafter of the bill. His testimony, and I have that here and I'll get it to you, cites a study by Avis Rent-A-Car that shows that cars equipped with daytime running headlights show 64% reduction in car damages and a 69% decrease in repair cost. Colleagues, this bill is about safety and sensibility. While current statutes require drivers to use headlights when limited visibility occurs, many may disagree when those conditions occur, resulting in unneeded accidents. I would appreciate if you consider the positive safety aspects of this bill. Thank you, and I'm open to question. The thing that I like about this bill is it doesn't cost any money. It means that you remember to turn on your headlights if you don't have those automatically set for your car, and it does. It saves lives, and it saves a lot of traffic accidents. Questions?
Thank you. Any Representative Widener?
Real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern with the bill is more the people that are usually driving cars that do not have automatic lights are people that are not in a strong financial situation lots of times. And if for some reason they forget to turn their lights on, they get pulled over, they get a ticket, and it kind of starts a downward spiral effect. So I'm just wondering about the fines and that would be putting on, because most of us have automatic lights. I mean, if you have a car that's 2000 or newer, they're all automatic headlights on them. And the older cars, like a teenager might be driving or somebody like that, if they forget to turn them on, the penalties they'll be facing.
Chair Beyer and Representative Widener, what I would say, it is our hope that there would be some latitude, that it would people would have several warnings, and we could put that in here if that would help. But this is not to penalize. It is about public safety. And I know I have a car that's a little older than yours, and it's finally taken me a while, but I've trained myself. Whenever I turn my ignition on, I turn my lights on, and and I would just hope that this is something that we could support, and with recommendation to the police departments, however, to give some latitude of warnings, but to remind people that it does make a difference. But I see your point very well.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, and I will pass around the testimony from my constituent.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
We have Bill Cross and Mel Yeager. Is that And hopefully we can be quick. I can turn the timer on and give you a couple minutes here.
Go for it. Okay. Madam Committee Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and we would like to go on record in support of the legislation. I think some issues in terms of not only operator and other drivers' safety, but pedestrians as well. And one of the things we noted is that your peripheral vision, oftentimes you may not detect a movement as quickly as you would a light. So pedestrians crossing crosswalks, that type of thing, just would be a little bit more advanced, you know, time to react. And so consequently, we think this would be a good bill and provides some safety opportunities for drivers, operators, and pedestrians.
Thank you. Mr.
Yeager. Madam Chair, or Co-Chair, Representative Beyer, and members of the committee, my name is Mel Yeager. I'm here as a citizen and as a representative of Motorcyclists of Oregon. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Bike Pack, and I've been in front of you before testifying. And I ask you to oppose this bill. In 1988, or thereabouts, a law was passed requiring motorcyclists to have their headlights on 24/7. The idea was to make them more visible to oncoming traffic. And since that time, more and more cars have been hitting the road with their headlights on, and it makes it more difficult for motorcyclists to be seen. Now, if you pass this law, what you're going to do is make those motorcyclists invisible. They'll just be another headlight amongst a sea of headlights out there. And it won't stop a car from pulling out in front of another car just because they have their headlights on. And it won't stop them from pulling out in front of a motorcycle because they never have stopped and give us the consideration in the past just because we're a motorcycle. I've had cars deliberately miss seeing me, making eye contact with me on my motorcycle, and then pulled out in front of me, and then realized what they were doing and stopped right in the middle of the lane. I've had to swerve very severely to keep from hitting the car, and been lucky all this time that I got around the cars that did that to me. I had my headlights on, but it still made me invisible for some reason. I could not understand why they couldn't see me. But believe me, there's a lot of people and a lot of cars and a lot of motorcycles, when they collide, the car driver that survives said, I didn't see him. I did not see him. It's not going to make any difference if, for the safety of motorcyclists, if this bill passes. It's going to make it worse. You're going to kill more motorcyclists because of it. I'm here in representing motorcyclists, and I ask you to please consider the ramifications of this bill and vote no on this bill. Thank you. I will answer any questions you may have.
Do I have questions from the committee? Seeing none.
Thank you.
That's all that we have signed up for that bill, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing.
Do you have any committee members left here?
Yeah.
To ask questions?
Well, there are, six maybe of us. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3072, and I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on 3377.
House Bill 3377 just authorizes photo radar in Salem in addition to the other cities. And Chief Jerry Moore is unable to show up to testify again today, but we do have Officer Steve Beard to testify.
Okay. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Heidi Stutzman once again, and I was just going to make that introduction. Our Chief of Police, Jerry Moore, was here last Friday and didn't quite get to our bill, and so he wasn't able to come today, and I did want to introduce Lieutenant Burr, who's here to speak for our bill, and also mention that you should have letters of support from the League of Oregon Cities, the City of Medford, and Representative Comp.
Vice Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Lieutenant Steve Burr. I'm with the Salem Police Department. I'm here today to ask for your support of House Bill 3377. This bill would simply add Salem to the list of cities already authorized by state statute to allow us to use photo radar for the enforcement of speed limits in our city. As the third largest city in the state of Oregon, our officers respond to a wide variety of calls for emergencies and public safety calls. Surprisingly, the number one complaint that we get is cars speeding in residential neighborhoods and in school zones. We feel that photo radar technology would just provide one additional tool to add to help enhance our efforts at making our community safer. Traffic safety is important to the City Council of Salem and also to our citizens. We feel photo radar will allow us to make positive changes in driving behavior. We have attached the report from the Oregon Department of Transportation, which clearly indicates photo radar is accepted by communities in which it operates and has a proven track record of reducing speeds and increasing safety in those communities. This is a very narrow bill. It only allows Salem the opportunity to join the other 10 cities currently authorized by state statute. We ask for your support in the passage of this bill, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Lindsay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Can you remind me how photo radar technically works?
Vice Chair Beyer, Representative Lindsay, basically you have to have a marked vehicle operated by a uniformed police officer that has a sign 100 to 400 yards prior to the approach of that vehicle, and then he sets thresholds based on the conditions, the weather conditions, traffic, and then a vehicle that would exceed that threshold, then the camera would be tripped and it would take a photo of that vehicle. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and follow up, I would just say, and that's the, when they take the flashlight, the big flash goes off and takes a picture of your car with your license plates, and then they...
That is correct.
Okay. I guess I'd just make a statement, and that is, it happened to me once, and I thought it was kind of caused some danger for me, because I was driving, and it was probably 5:30, but dark, and that light went off, and it was so bright, I literally just... shunned my eyes there for a good 5 seconds till they recalibrated, and then I was able to find out where I was. That flash was incredibly bright. So for whatever it's worth, I raised that to just for safety standards to get that corrected somehow.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Weiner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Question is, right now when an officer pulls somebody over, they have some discretion on the circumstances and the situation that was there. With photo radar, it's just guilt automatically. Even if something was wrong or something else went in front of it, you're guilty automatically. There's no discretion or anything that takes place where an officer there performing the service, he has some discretion as, oh, this is what happened, why they had to accelerate, or a situation that happened. Or maybe it's the mother who's dropping her kids off at daycare, she's late for work, trying to get her life back in order. He has some discretion. Hey, she can't afford to pay the ticket, she's trying to do the right thing, I want to help her out here. There's no options with photo radar. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on that, because you're guilty automatically, and it can be very harmful to some of the citizens of Salem.
Vice Chair Beyer, Representative Weidner, discretion is really a two-edged sword. It can also be argued that discretion creates discrimination. And so I would say to you, from an enforcement standpoint, if you exceed the threshold, then you're treated equally as everyone else. It's not the job of police to adjudicate the citation. That responsibility belongs with the court. In the city of Salem, we have a violations bureau, and you can contact the violations bureau and you can show them your driving record and whatever, and they decide what the fine is. It's never been our position, nor should it ever be our position, to decide what penalty is assessed to a particular citation.
And because you do have the photo radar unit is manned, I think there's an opportunity to have somebody there that would be there in court.
I don't think the bill says that the photo radar is manned.
It is.
It does, Representative Weidner, by law. I don't see it particularly. It may be in a related
ORS.
Statute, ORS, but it does say it must be manned.
Yeah.
And in addition, within, I think it's 100 feet, you have to actually have a display board that displays the speed of the vehicle. So between the flash that Representative Lindsay discussed, the display, the visual display, the violator would know instantly that they were just caught speeding.
There, I've experienced them in Beaverton, and they are very well marked, and I think it really is more of a deterrent. You know, you see them, they're marked, you see it approaching them.
So now, if I may, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I know, and we discussed this in my office, but Arizona, they're starting to take them all out, so because they've had some serious issues with them. So they're leaving them in some places, but they've pulled them off the interstates and everywhere else, so because it got to where people were messing with them, so...
That's just my opinion. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that was all we had signed up. And so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3377 and open a public hearing on... I'll go with Gelser since she's here. 3292. And Representative Gelser may come up. Do you have anyone you need to bring with you? I think we have a few people signed up. Oh. So we have Don Gerhart, and I don't want to butcher a name, so I'll let you come up. And go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sheriff. Representative Reed, you look different today.
I do. I think I shrunk a few inches today.
Only a couple. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. I am State Representative Sarah Gelser from Corvallis and Philomath. House Bill 3292 is a bill that comes to you out of an economic development listening session that I hosted in Corvallis last fall. We met with a number of successful businesses in our community to talk about what would start bringing more jobs to Oregon and encourage economic development in Oregon. And this idea in particular came out of a conversation with the individual who founded Home Dialysis Plus, which brought, I believe, about $90 million of venture capital, not just into the state of Oregon, but into my district. It's a very exciting opportunity down there in Corvallis. And one of the things that we talked about was how slow the commercialization process is out of our university system, where we have patents that are sitting there, oodles of good ideas that are not being acted upon and moved to market quickly enough because we simply do not have the capacity or the staff to make that happen. And the idea was that we've got Onami and all of these other programs, but we wanted something that was much broader and creating some positions that could go through, sort through what is really Oregon's great idea bank and identify those ideas that are most promising. Go out, sell those, say, come to Oregon, we have great ideas, we will sell you this patent, you can take it to market, but you must do your research and development, your production here in the state of Oregon. And that really is the simple concept behind this bill, building on the good ideas of Oregonians, making sure that we make the profit off of those here in Oregon and that we build jobs here in Oregon.
Thank you. Committee. Representative Lindsay, Representative Sheehan, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just, I think the intention's great. I just wonder if the system's already in place, and that is a private equity fund system that we have, the best in the world in America. I'm an intellectual property attorney. I work closely with this. We've spun out technology from OHSU. Each university has a great entrepreneurial program in place that helps students, sometimes gives awards to students. In fact, as my law firm, if a student wins an award such as at University of Portland, we do all pro bono to get their entity set up, to get the licensing in place, and we actually go out and try to help them find the funding. I guess it's more of a statement, but I guess I would like to hear your response to that. I just think that the private equity market is already in place to go out and hunt for those ideas. And on top of that, every university that I know has an entrepreneurial system in place to help spin those ideas out. And this seems like a new program, duplicative of a system that's already in place. Am I wrong?
Representative Lindsay, Chair, I keep wanting to say Reed because of the placard, Chair Beyer. Thank you for the question. We certainly do have strong entrepreneurial programs at our universities, and certainly the Austin School of Business at Oregon State University in my district is a great example of that. Unfortunately, the process remains too slow. We have good ideas. We should not have to wait. Having people that are dedicated to mining those ideas and getting them out, moving them out into the private market, we're talking about moving these out into the private market, is a good thing to do. We had one individual in Corvallis that in a single year exceeded the number of patents that came out of Oregon State University just within the last 15 years. We can work faster. We can work better. Putting the person power behind that will help us get that done.
Thank you. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gelser, can you, my question's pretty similar to Representative Lindsay's. It's probably just a little bit more clumsy. Can you very quickly describe kind of how the process works right now and why that's not working well and what it would look like under this scenario and getting this information to a potential investor or purchaser?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Beyer, again, the intent behind this is having a focused person or people whose sole job it is to mine the idea files within our university system. It's to speed up the process as it currently exists because many of us believe that it is too slow.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So is there a marketing arm to this? Is this, or is this just housing a bunch of the data and finding it in case someone goes looking for it? Or is this then going to be marketed to the world in some way?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Beyer, the idea is that the data is kind of sitting there going fallow, hidden in file drawers and computer databases. You have someone that is going out, pulling out these ideas, identifying the most promising ideas, and then, yes, marketing them. Marketing them, trying to draw people in. And that hook is, you come, we'll sell you this idea, you can own it, you can take it to market, but you have to do it here in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill. It's really important. It's a really important area. I'll give one example for the record. The Washington State started doing something somewhat similar, trying to step up their sort of IP work through their Economic Development Agency, and they did a call for patents. And in that call for patents, they found an invention for once I started telling this story, I forgot what the punchline was. But anyway, they found a patent for a device that would allow a woman to go to the restroom outside. And they ended up, it was a funnel device, and they ended up selling hundreds of thousands of these things, you know, huge revenue to, I think, to the U.S. military because they did this public call for patents. And the... And my question, if you already have, or comment if we haven't, if we've learned what Washington has done, how they're doing their tech transfer, they're doing it better than us, it seems to be from a distance. California might be also. Do we know what they're doing? Can we learn anything from them or other states?
Representative Smith, the placard is really, really getting me. Chair Beyer. I have not spent a lot of time. Thank you. Now that I don't have to think about Representative Beyer's name, I could go and talk to Washington and do a better comparison. This is an idea that's come from really smart people in my district who are concerned about
great.
Business.
I think it's great and wonder. I think it's great.
So, and I don't want to cut you guys short, but we have a little more work to do, but go ahead.
You want me to go first? Chair Beyer. And members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Arundeep Singh Pradhan, for the record. I am the Associate Vice President for Technology Transfer and Business Development at Oregon Health and Science University. What is proposed in this bill, as has been pointed out in the discussion, already exists. And we currently have, for example, a technology portal called the Innovate Collaborate Oregon Portal, which catalogs and brings ideas together from all of the research-intensive universities in Oregon, where somebody can actually go ahead and take a look at those. Specifically at OHSU and even at the other universities, we have all made significant commitments to commercialization of university research. The process is involved. It's intensive. It's not just merely mining ideas. It is a relationship that exists between the people in my office, the faculty, and the business community. Just to give you an example, at OHSU, we receive one invention every 3 days. We file one patent application every 3 days. We commercialize, we enter into one commercial agreement every 8.5 days. We want to enter into one collaboration agreement every 4.5 days. And we execute one material transfer agreement every day. So the resources are available. Our fear is that a parallel infrastructure with an OBD would, instead of augmenting this effort, would actually hamper this effort, because we now would be required to coordinate our efforts with OBD as opposed to dedicating the resources and the limited staff that we have to mining those ideas and moving the technology forward. One of the things that we do well, and this is communicating at all levels between the university, between our faculty, between our respective offices, and between the leadership of the university, is recognize how important this is for the Oregon innovation ecosystem. We all have programs that implement, encourage entrepreneurs, not only within the university community, but also in Oregon. We also have highly qualified professionals who do this. These professionals need to have an understanding of science, business, and law. Most of us have advanced science degrees. Most of us have MBAs. Some of us have JDs. And it is this that allows us to go in and understand what the potential business applications for our research are. I say this on behalf of not only OHSU, but also the Oregon University System Research Council. The last item that I would like to talk about is specific to OHSU, and which is our bond rating. So as everybody is aware, OHSU exists in a slightly different governance structure outside of OUS, and we have the ability to issue our own bonds. In those bonds, we make representation about our income, and that includes income from intellectual property. And it's these representations that allow us to get that credit rating that we do get. We feel that any laws that even bring into question whether we control this income or not have the potential to have an adverse effect on that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Don, you want to add something here?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Don Gerhardt. I'm Associate Vice President for Research and Innovation at the University of Oregon. Following up on the comments by Arun, clearly the sponsors of HB 3292 had hoped to encourage the use of Oregon's university-created intellectual property to foster innovation-based economic development in our state. This is a worthy goal and one that we fully support, I and my technology transfer colleagues. We have serious concerns, however, regarding the unintended consequences of HB 3292. We believe the bill would dramatically increase the cost and bureaucratic complexity of technology commercialization in our state, and it would seriously undermine Oregon's competitiveness. HB 3292 would create a new state government program that would divert scarce resources to staff, equip, and operate a redundant centralized unit within the Oregon Business Development Department. OBDD currently has no expertise to catalog, market, and coordinate the commercialization of university-created intellectual property. Expanded marketing is called for under HB 3292 would provide little benefit to the University of Oregon. And here I note that there are very few patented UN innovations that have gone unutilized. If you look at the 39 U.S. patents that have been issued to U.S. since the start of fiscal 2001, 90% of those have been optioned or licensed at this point. I note as well that a published study ranked the University of Oregon third nationally among the mid-sized research universities for innovation yield, that is, the production of innovation-based income, as a percentage of the institution's research expenditures. In addition, because 3292 would require private sector companies to restrict all their Oregon intellectual property-related, quote, research, business, or other employment, unquote, to the state of Oregon, the unintended consequences of the bill are disturbing to contemplate. Consider the following hypothetical example. If a university researcher were to discover a breakthrough new drug with the potential to cure, let's say, a childhood disease, then under HB 3292, a multinational pharmaceutical company acquiring the patent rights would not be able to conduct clinical research outside Oregon, and therefore could not make the investigational medicine available to sick children in other states or nations. Or consider another example. If an Oregon University researcher were to create a new process that massively reduced the cost of semiconductor manufacturing, then under HB 3292, any company acquiring the IP rights would not be able to use the improved process in any fabrication plants outside Oregon.
And I hate to be rude, and we're going to get kicked out of here quickly. I need to do a couple little things, and so
sure.
Do you want to wrap it up real quick?
Okay, so obviously such sorts of constraints would be unacceptable to private sector entities, and that would in turn compromise our ability to continue to be successful in this domain. Thank you again, Co-Chair, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Beyer, very quickly, one additional comment. Majority of the research at universities is conducted with federal funds, and there are federal requirements under the Bayh-Dole Act that research be made available generally to the public, and there are no restrictions within whether you license it within a state.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the testimony. I appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3292. I'm going to quickly open a public hearing on House Bill 3483. Zach.
There's nobody signed up to testify. We have written testimony from Representative Wisnett.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 3483. Go ahead. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2331. Any testimony? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close House Bill 2331 and carry it over. And I'm going to open House Bill 3528, public hearing, and you got a minute. No.
Madam Chair, I recognize the sort of Damocles resting above us. The Progress Board is an independent board created by the legislature to monitor the state's long-term strategic vision, Oregon Shines. 12-member panel is made up of citizen leaders who oversee it. They track benchmarks to help that our decision-making process hopefully is more outcomes-based so we can track longitudinal results for how Oregon is actually doing. I have three parts. That was part one. Part two, we'll be making significant amendments to this bill based on recent conversations with Mike Jordan, the head of DAS, a similar position to an early bill that we heard today waiting for the change over the administration. The plan in this bill is relatively simple, to have the Progress Board execute or make recommendations for the following three things. One, how they could merge purposes, duties, and powers with another commission or other commissions or departments in state government to help streamline some of this stuff. Two, how the Progress Board's benchmarks can be better integrated within the state budgeting process, and three, where the board should be housed. It currently is permitted to do so under a statute that was passed last session, and we need either them to do that or make that recommendation. That was about a minute.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much for that, and hopefully no questions. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3528, and I am going to announce we are carrying over work sessions on House Bill 2329, 3372, House Bill 3458, House Bill 3292, House Bill 3528, and House Bill 3055. And we are adjourned.